I'm Jason Lewis.
I'm Flora Gladwin.
And I'm Thomas Mills.
Welcome to Climate Optimists. As a group of concerned citizens, we're on a journey to explore climate solutions and ways that each of us can make a difference. And as a nonprofit organization, it's donations from our listeners that enable us to empower and educate people to become climate advocates. So whether you're a longtime listener or you just discovered us and like what you hear, consider a donation. Donating is easy. You just need to head over to our website, climateoptimists.co, and click that big donate button. If you're not ready to become a donor but want to help us out, make sure you tell your friends about us and rate us on your streaming platform.
As we mentioned in our last episode, we're planning on switching to a spring and fall season, autumn, that is, for listeners outside the US. The change will enable us to invest more energy into both virtual and local events. But to make sure we don't lose touch with you guys, head over to our website and sign up for the monthly newsletter. And also make sure if you are listening to us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts that you're actually subscribed. And this will ensure that you get notifications every time a new episode comes out.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely head on over there and do that. So for this week, all of us are all too familiar with how our current linear economy works. A product gets designed and manufactured to do one thing, maximize profit. This often means a shortened lifespan, sometimes as little as a single use, increased difficulty or even impossibility to repair, and a manufacturing process done without recycling or reuse in mind. It also typically means the use of virgin materials and that a product is simply discarded at the end of its life. As you can imagine, the linear model is a major source of global greenhouse gas emissions and takes a huge toll on our environment. But the good news is that there's a different approach gaining momentum called a circular economy. In today's episode, we're going to be exploring what it means to be circular, how to get there, and what it could mean for our climate. But before we jump in, let's talk about this week's reason for hope.
So for this week, our reason for hope comes from Norway, which, for those who keep track of electric vehicles, this will not be a surprise, but they are on track to have more EVs in the country than gasoline cars by, depending on forecasts, the end of this year, early 2025. Wow. And in another couple years, the forecast is that there will be more EVs than diesel cars on the road as well. It's worth noting that Norway is also the first nation scheduled to phase out internal combustion engines starting next year, 2025. And EVs already represent around 80% or more of new vehicles sold. So super exciting to hear how much progress Norway is making. I don't know if you guys have thoughts as well.
I think it's like a great example of what can be done when you bother to try. I mean, we've got right now, we have Australia backpedaling on their emissions requirements because of pressure from the legacy automakers. And it's like, hey guys, like, why are we backpedaling this? Here's a country that next year will be transitioning to 100% EV sales and we're struggling to implement fuel economy standards. It's just a joke. So congratulations to them. It's amazing that they've got as far as they have.
Yeah, agreed. If you're in Norway, pat yourself on the back. Great news to hear you guys are making so much progress.
Absolutely. And hopefully we can all learn from that as well. And with that, let's get to our main topic. Our guests today are Mariana Novak and Matthew Fraser from a global impact organization called Circle Economy, formed in 2011 and based in Amsterdam. To date, Circle Economy has worked with over 80 businesses, 31 cities, and 20 nations around the world. Their vision is an economic system that ensures that the planet and all people can thrive. Matthew is the director of Circularity Gap Solutions, and Mariana is the lead of the Circularity Gap Reporting Initiative.
Yeah, stoked to have them on the podcast today. Matthew, Mariana, welcome to Climate Optimists.
Nice to be here.
Thanks for having us.
So, don't often have two guests on the interview, but I'd love to hear both of your thoughts. When you think about efforts to address climate change, what makes you hopeful? And maybe, Mariana, I'll have you go first.
Sure. Well, there are a couple of things, but one thing I've noticed working in the space is how very positive and collaborative everybody is. I don't think that it's so common that you can reach out to people on LinkedIn or otherwise meet them at events, and everyone is very keen to figure out how they fit together, how their organizations can work together to align on the goals and solve the challenges together. So that really makes me think that we're working on it and something will come out of it.
What about you, Matthew?
Yeah, I think also looking at, you know, the trends over the past couple of years or even decade, what you know, undeniably see is like the steady march of technological progress. So I think, you know, you do see amazing innovations that are, you know, continuing to come to market and, you know, achieve the kind of scale that we imagined. And, you know, even if you rewind 20 or 30 years ago, that kind of scale and progress really wasn't possible, certainly. And then I think on the other hand, also when you look at, you know, the more broad adoption of policies, certainly international collaboration, cooperation.
Right.
But even, you know, like at the topic that we'll talk about today, which is, you know, circular economy, kind of a bit of a fringe topic within the larger sustainability field, definitely next to things like climate change. But there are, you know, countries and even regions like the EU that have, you know, really progressive and quite bold legislation on that. So,
yeah, agreed. And definitely excited to talk about a circular economy. I feel like, you know, we start talking about solutions to reducing, you know, consumption and waste, end up having the potential to have a lot of positive change, whether we're talking about, you know, climate change or biodiversity loss, you know, et cetera. Well, let's dive in. For those who don't, you know what the circular economy is, maybe start there. I don't know if either one of you want to jump in.
Yeah, maybe I can jump in. So I think the original definition, or at least the analogy of a circular economy, really kind of dates back like well into the 80s, where you have this sort of concept of industrial symbiosis. So the idea that we can design sort of human-made industrial systems at scale in a way that, you know, mimics nature. You always hear this phrase of, you know, like a tree doesn't produce waste, you know, the leaves fall in the fall and bugs eat them, and, you know, cycle right. of life kind of thing. And I think that's a little bit where the analogy was born. And but, you know, getting down to the definition itself, it's often kind of claimed as being an economic system that is closed loop and regenerative by design. I think when you look at the kind of broader principles that are espoused under circular economy, it really is, in my mind anyway, a bit more of a toolbox to move towards sufficiency. So certainly there are these elements of kind of like closed loop, you know, regenerative biocycle, things like that. But a lot of the principles that we use in our work are really related to material. So how can we reduce the amount of material input from the start? How can we slow or extend those life cycles of materials? And then, of course, you know, the traditional kind of closing the loops, cycling them, whether that's in the technical or the biological category of materials. But I think those kind of cover the broad principles of what a circular economy actually aims to do.
That makes sense. So, I mean, leading into, I guess, the next obvious question, why is it important, right? I mean, what's the value that we're intending to kind of produce with a circular economy?
Yeah, well, maybe I'll start with that one as well. Like, I think obviously materials are extremely important in many ways, really central to kind of two things. One, on one hand, is really providing the essential needs of humanity, of our civilization. So materials from concrete, steel, you know, what have you, really do service people's needs. On the other hand, they create impact through their extraction, processing, management, and disposal.
Right.
And when you do apply those principles of, you know, narrowing materials from the get-go, slowing them, so extending lifetimes, regenerating and cycling, what you do have a handle on now is how to optimize that kind of ratio. So how do we actually deliver more needs or satisfy more needs for dramatically less environmental costs? And one way that you can think about that is sort of taking a bike to work versus taking a car to work. I mean, the sort of unit of mobility is the same, one person year of commuting, let's say like that. But right. Not only the sort of vehicle that you use, but also the infrastructure that supports that decision is almost orders of magnitude different. You know, if you imagine sort of like a middle, you know, middle Texas, you know, sort of interstate, you know, highways, freeways, all needed just to support people driving their cars every day versus, a place like Amsterdam, which is where our office is based. I think it's somewhere like 60% of people cycle to work, and the city is extremely compact, very efficient.
That makes sense. I mean, I think we all recognize, especially, as global population top, 8 billion here recently, that we have finite resources. And so being able to stretch those further makes sense. Marianne, any additional thoughts from your end?
Yeah. So we spoke a bit about started the conversation around climate change. And I think that's also where the circular economy can play a really important role, because there's a lot of goals and targets at national level and at industry level and organization level about becoming net zero, reducing emissions and understanding those targets. But many of those, the plans of how to actually reduce the emissions or what strategies to employ at a business level, at a value chain level, we don't really know exactly what to do. So the circular economy offers a really helpful and practical way of thinking about how can I change my relationship with materials and resources and then model the effect it will have on emissions. And well, we did that study at the global level, and there's other studies as well by some other similar organizations which talk about how at 50% of the emissions can be reduced from this just changing the way we use materials.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
so it can have quite a big effect.
So I'm thinking, in terms of examples, having recycled steel, for instance, in the construction of a building, or, reusing, aggregate to make concrete, instead of starting from scratch. I mean, I don't know if there are other examples that you'd sort of highlight in terms of being able to move to more of that circular model.
Yeah. So, I think one of the challenges is that products are made in a way that they can't at all be reused anyways, either from their own life cycle perspective or from the perspective of once you take the products apart, then the components, they may be glued together or something like that, and you can't actually reuse those components. A good example could also be just at the level of buildings. So buildings are quite resource intensive, and some buildings have been around for hundreds of years, right? And they still can be used. We just have to repurpose kind of the interior. But as time has moved on, a building life cycle has been economically valued to last only 20 or 30 years. And then those buildings typically can't be taken apart in a way where the components are reused. Maybe they can physically, like you can take the window panes out or you can take some of the tiles out if you're careful. But there's not really a market or a means to store those window panes, those tiles, those bricks, and just keep them in a way that's safe so that they can be reused and built into a new building. So we'd have to kind of change the way we think about buildings from a number of perspectives. One is that once it's there, can we put up buildings that will be flexible and last for hundreds of years? Because we've proven already that many buildings can last that long and continue to be safe. And then if we do need to take one down, then how can we build up the infrastructure and the technologies to remove the components and kind of use them in a new building that gets built?
So it's both the consideration, of sort of initial design and how you're, thinking about the design life of the building. And then I assume in addition to that, if you're designing, thinking about how it could be deconstructed.
Exactly. Yeah. Just considering the whole life cycle of the building and of each of the products and components that go into it.
So kind of taking that example, I guess, of a building, are there, specific kind of pieces of legislation that need to occur or things that need to occur to kind of encourage that behavior? Because I'm assuming, right, it's probably not a technological issue to design a building to last for, a long time and to design it in a way that it could be deconstructed, right? I'm assuming it's economics that drive the current model.
I think what's especially tricky about kind of circular economy once you get into it is like, it really does take that systems perspective. So indeed, precisely as you say, I mean, there are decisions that really should be taken right up front in the design phase. So for example, are we going to build the building with, carbon intensive materials like steel, concrete? There's also locally sourced timber frame, cross laminated timber. All of these are kind of buzzwords about, how to lock in carbon into the envelope, the structure of the building. Certainly how you maintain it and the kinds of contracts that you have with either the tenants of the building or the maintenance companies and how materials are kind of moved around there and maintained. But then certainly when it comes to kind of end of life, there are actually quite significant technical barriers as well. So actually for yeah, again, like actually a reason to be hopeful. Concrete, you know, like I forget the statistic, but something like 7% of global CO2, probably the most used material on Earth, actually was very difficult to separate back down at its end of life into cement and aggregate. And there are actually just in the past maybe 5 or 6 years, there have been quite some technical innovations that have actually made that possible. So now we can have concrete cycled over multiple life cycles, and there's a mobile unit that can be taken to the demo site. The concrete is crushed back into its constituent elements and then repurposed again. So one thing, obviously, we've worked quite closely with the city of Amsterdam for a number of years, and we've actually really helped them, well, confront and deal with a lot of these difficult challenges as they emerge. And actually, precisely as Mariana pointed out, is there just is no market, that there's no physical place where a lot of these materials are stored. There's no kind of clear mechanism on pricing.
But speaking of Amsterdam, they actually do have quite ambitious goals in this area. They have a plan to kind of halve material use in a couple of key sectors and across the city by 2030, and then to become a fully circular city by 2050. And the built environment is one of their key focus areas. And they're introducing and working with multidisciplinary groups, so say industry and policymakers and research organizations, to understand what those targets should be in more detail for companies, for different material groups. There's a lot of discourse about that in industry, in the city, about how can we actually meet this goal.
Yeah, so obviously setting up new markets for reused materials is not a trivial thing. I was going to ask, and I think you sort of touched on this, like how does that process take place? Is it, you know, starting with kind of pilot projects, technological feasibility, and then once you've sort of proven a concept, and then, you know, as a matter of putting in appropriate incentives or disincentives? I mean, I don't know if there's kind of a framework for, you know, setting these markets up.
I don't think there's a framework, but there are some. I mean, I think it depends also a little bit on the industry to see like who's guiding the innovation, right? Because, and even the region. So if you look at consumer goods and just changing business models about, say, access over ownership, something where you have a little bit more like agency to change it from a business perspective, you know, you change your business model, then you already see a proliferation of companies that are doing this in Europe, sure, but a lot in the States as well. There's really a lot of examples of like these shared clothing platforms or sharing goods platforms at the consumer level. But then if you take something, okay, again, like clothing, then we've got at the industry level, at the global level, a huge amount of textile waste. And then at the bottom of the chain is kind of material reuse or trying to process the material into new material streams. And yeah, there it's really at the phase of like where you bring some companies together, usually in partnership with a research organization, and you've got a technology that you've built out, you know, maybe with some PhD students or something like that. And then you build it out. Right. It's like really small, you know, once you're really starting with this technology, do it at like backyard, in your backyard kind of thing. But there's such a big market, right? So as soon as these technologies are proven, then you've really got a good opportunity to scale, you know, or at least you've got the market who's demanding this technology.
So in kind of thinking about this, and I know legislation can get really kind of wonky for people, but are there kind of basic ways to think about the types of things that need to be put into place to encourage a more circular economy?
On one hand, I think, you know, if we even zoom out to the biggest level, the highest level, I think there's a really healthy debate within the sustainability community happening now, which is really kind of like, how do we define progress? And, you know, especially moving beyond growth, I think there that actually, it actually right. does touch on quite an important element, which is that kind of central ratio that I was bringing up before, which is, you know, we have human well-being on one hand, you know, environmental impact or, you know, planetary boundaries, let's say, on the other. So I think Kate Raworth did a really great job at kind of, you know, conceptualizing, imagining this kind of donut economy. And already what you see is almost no government today really seriously kind of measures progress along those dimensions. It really is kind of, you know, GDP growth. Certainly when you also go back to the example of, well, should I build a city or a new district of a city with, you know, excellent, you know, roads and car infrastructure, or do we think about, you know, public transport, human transport? Actually, that kind of initial dimension of kind of well-being versus environmental impact already gives you that kind of useful framework to begin to make some of those high-level decisions. And then certainly what you get into after that is, well, legislation on resource efficiency, material efficiency, things like waste codes, but also in addition to right to repair, which is, I think, a little bit more geared towards consumers, also things like extended producer responsibility, EPR. So actually making sure that in law, if I'm, you know, producing a whole bunch of phones and electronics, I'm legally obliged to take those back at the end of life. And of course, as a business, I would have some flexibility in how I would set that up. So there's an opportunity for me to kind of lean into, let's say, more of a circular business model where you don't buy the phone off me, you pay a sort of subscription fee or a use fee, but I own it as a company. I own it. I provide repair, maintenance services on that. And, you know, when you're done with it, it comes back to me and I can repurpose that to be tooled up into a new phone or different components.
Yeah. And even more upstream, like to the actual stewardship of the materials and resources themselves, we have to enable these industries to work with the resources and to protect them in a way. And so what I'm missing a lot of is the kind of conservation and preservation efforts. So it's a lot about like how to improve industry, how to reduce or like make industry more efficient and, you know, reduce consumption. So as you asked earlier, what are the policies or incentives that we need to kind of provide at a higher level? You know, it's not very lucrative to work in conservation. Right. So why not? Like, why don't we make that actually a stellar job and kind of try and create something there? You know, there is already like these more romantic, like ecotourism, agritourism, but at a larger scale, what about conservation at a larger scale, preservation at a larger scale? And turning that into an industry with an immediate kind of direct positive impact.
So it's hard to sort of simplify these things or distill them into, you know, to sound bites. But it does sound like in one sense, if I'm understanding you, it's like, let's start, for instance, measuring the thing that we want to see more of, right? And then it sounds like in addition to that, you know, wherever there's a behavior that we want to see that isn't happening today, how do we make that economically desirable? You know, Mariana, to your point about conservation, like how do we make conservation something that companies are interested in doing, as opposed to it being sort of a thought on the side, maybe.
Yeah, I think that's a good summary.
Knowing the U.S. is companies here are very motivated by, you know, I want to sell more goods, more and more volume. It can feel like, especially in the electronics sector, like say cell phones or clothing, that it's like you need to have that next thing. Maybe you mentioned this already, Matthew, but wondering what kind of things we need to do to change that corporate behavior.
I mean, you do have some really standout brands. So a few come to mind, like Patagonia, things like, you know, Red Wing shoes. I think, you know, they're very central to the brand is the idea that like we really do take care of, you know, the environment from start to finish, right from the design phase. And they have repair and maintenance services built into their business model. But then I think you do point it out where it's like there can be companies that, you know, invest heavily and they exist on the fringe, but that's, you know, not really like a mass adopted business model. And I think that the challenge is there. It's like, well, how do we get kind of all companies to do this as the norm from the get-go? I think ultimately a lot of that has to do, or a lot of it comes down to kind of two things. One is just regulation. So one thing that we've, work with a lot of cities is just, you know, really hiking the landfill tax. I'm not exactly sure how it works in the United States, but, you know, obviously just making the kind of status quo option much more expensive than. I think the other thing is then economics and actually how do we get the incentives right? So obviously one of the kind of holy grails in the sustainability field is, you know, how do we price in externalities and, you know, give everything like a true cost?
And coupled with that, I think will be trying to support the either upskilling or reskilling of workers for this new kind of way of working in the economy. So to change the, when we spoke about our building example or any other kind of example, all along the value chain, we need to have awareness of what is the circular economy, but then how does it apply to my level of the supply chain? Like, what new types of manufacturing do we need to do? How do we need to change those business models? And that kind of like skilling exercise needs to happen too. And I think if there's maybe there's some companies who also want to work on these topics, but actually we don't have enough people who really know about it, a lot about it. So we want to bring in that kind of skills element as well, which I think also help move things along.
One, I can imagine in a world where, you know, feels like people are being kind of automated out of jobs, right? I know that's a concern for some. There's probably opportunities within the circular economy to create new jobs, right? You know, we're talking about repair. Repair usually requires more labor. So as we're having this whole discussion, you know, I mean, I know myself excited about the prospect of realizing a more circular economy. Wondering, you know, if people are hearing this and it resonates with them, whether that's just from a climate perspective or, you know, or otherwise, what can individuals be doing to kind of help affect or advocate for a circular economy?
I think what the data bears out is however you can consume less, that's really the kind of biggest lever. So again, kind of reverting back to the circular economy principles, do I need this in the first place, right? So even up higher in that R ladder is refuse, you know, like, you know, is this something that I really need? But then certainly if I do buy something, can I, you know, what can I do to keep it for longer, you know? So things like buying something that can be repaired rather than not, or, you know, buying a high quality item, but, you know, it lasts a lifetime. Thinking of, you know, a cast iron pan, for example, that would last you probably hundreds of years. rather than, you know, like a cheap aluminum Teflon thing that you can bend in your hands. And then, you know, of course, I think there's also, if you kind of zoom a bit more out to community level or a bit of like the more global level, however you can support businesses that are, you know, adopting circular business models. I think, you know, in many ways that kind of speaks to the whole, like, you know, vote with your wallet kind of mentality, where I think there's a lot of innovation happening around circularity. And if you can put your money toward that, that helps build the momentum.
That's true, Matt, actually. Like, we made the goal to, you know, like when we furnished our apartment, to like get secondhand stuff. And you actually have to really change the way you think about shopping, like, and think about your stuff, you know. If you wanted to get it on those secondhand markets, like, you have to be way more patient. You have to kind of choose from what's there, as opposed to like have a concept and get it at no matter what cost. You also, if you're in the secondhand market, you buy things with the perspective to resell them. So you have a very different kind of appetite to bring anything into your house, because you know you're going to have to be reselling it. And so you're like, no, what's good and what's not. You know, it makes you way more practical, actually, with the stuff that you buy. You're like, actually, this is not a good made thing. Like, it will just fall apart, or, you know, you kind of are way more strict on that front. So yeah, I think we actually need to work harder to bring those principles into our day-to-day life. What you said with the goes back to the vote with your wallet and kind of change the way you think about your own things.
Well, it's been great talking to both of you about this topic. Exciting to hear that, you know, I think there's probably more progress being made than I was even aware of. Obviously a lot more work to do, but clearly some huge benefits for us as a society if we can, you know, become more circular. And for all of us here at Climate Optimus, huge benefits for the climate as well. So thank you for coming on and talking about the topic with us, sharing your knowledge, and of course for the work you're doing there.
Thank you so much for having us and hosting us. It was very nice to talk to you.
Well, I don't know about you guys, but I definitely enjoyed the interview with Mariana and Matthew. I was already, you know, somewhat familiar with the concept of a circular economy, but definitely came away, I think, more of an evangelist. I think another thing they pointed out, and I think is just worth reiterating, is why it's so important that we move to a circular economy. And, you know, there's a couple big reasons for this. First, you know, today we're using about 60% more resources than the world can continue to provide. So we're really on borrowed time when it comes to that. In addition, you know, for climate optimists and our listeners, our linear system today is responsible for about 50% of global carbon emissions. That is, you know, we save that if we make the shift to a circular model. And, you know, for those who care about biodiversity loss, 80% of it globally can be linked to this linear model that we're continuing to use. And, you know, not to mention all the waste, right? You know, I just think it's worth reiterating how critical it is that we move to this. You know, it's not just a nice to have. It's really, I think, in my mind, an imperative. What about you, Thomas, Flora?
Wow. No, I think that's a really wonderful point. I definitely agree. I think the first thing that I did after listening through the interview was immediately look into what implementation actually looks like at the consumer level. And you can find lots of examples of legislation pertaining to circular economy, particularly right to repair laws, which our guests talked a lot about. You know, in fact, in the US, 33 states considered right to repair laws in the 2023 legislative cycle, with Colorado, California, New York, Massachusetts, and Minnesota already having those laws enacted. But as you can imagine, there's a huge amount of variation in exactly what these laws call for. I looked a little specifically at the California law versus the New York law. In California, the law makes manufacturers responsible for tools, parts, software, and documentation for 7 years after production for devices that cost more than $100. Meanwhile, in New York's case, the right to repair law still allows manufacturers to sell ensembles instead of just individual parts. So, for example, if your computer breaks, you might still have to pay for the whole motherload, or in this case, motherboard, instead of just your broken part. So ultimately, though, legislation is a first. Yeah, really interesting. And it does go to show that legislation is going to be that first and critical step, but, you know, not the end all. Implementation is going to matter, especially because our environmental benefit will still depend on how we go about extending the lives of those devices. So,
yeah, the details definitely matter.
Yeah, look, on this topic, there were a couple of things that struck me. One was something you often hear, and that is that the best part is no part at all, and the best service is no service at all, or no requirement for service at all. But you look at a smartphone, right? Like back in the day, you had an alarm clock, you had a calculator, you had maybe a portable GPS, and now all of that is bundled into one device. So I think advancements like that, like technology advancements, will help us if we use these, you know, this technology and the associated rules correctly, reduce our carbon emissions and associated environmental impact accordingly. The other part of it, I think, that is really important is putting a proper price on waste. And I know that I rant a lot about putting a price on carbon and, you know, at $40 a ton, that we are totally underpricing the cost of truly sequestering carbon. And I feel that it's very similar when it comes to disposal of waste, that, you know, here in Tasmania, the price is $21 a metric ton. Right, that is just catastrophically low. And because of it, there's no recycling industry here, right? It just basically doesn't exist. If you have low value goods, like low value waste products, like plastics, for example, nobody wants to take them. Whereas you go to somewhere like New South Wales, where that same ton of waste is going to cost you $163 to dispose of.
It is pretty crazy. And I think you're right, Thomas, like, it is about having sort of the carrots up front, right, and the infrastructure to help people deal with their waste. And then on the back end, you know, making sure that waste costs enough. And that, I think, highlights the importance of another tool that Marianne and Matthew talk about, which is extended producer responsibility. And for those who are wondering, well, what is extended producer responsibility? It really is about, you know, ensuring there's accountability for a product at the end of life. So, you know, whether that's the cell phone maker, the car maker, you know, the dishwasher maker, that those producers and distributors are taking accountability for that waste. And the UK actually has a pretty robust extended producer responsibility policy in place. You know, it covers everything from packaging to electronic equipment, batteries, end of life vehicles. And it really is focused on like, how do you minimize waste in products, promote reuse, you know, enhance recovery and recycling. And then, you know, you design things to be repairable and reusable, right? So you're really embracing this idea of circularity. Like, how do we minimize what we're using, use more recycled materials, and, you know, ultimately have something we can fix when it breaks.
And there was so much interesting technology too around EPR that ended up absorbing a lot of my time while I was researching for the pod. There's so many interesting things like startups using AI coupled with sensors to sort waste, since, you know, that still presents a really large issue for recycling companies.
Right.
The development of bio-based materials. I found one company that uses fungal mycelium to make their materials, which is wild. And then, of course, and I think this is probably the biggest one for EPR, tech like blockchain, which, I don't know, do you guys think that's old news or still exciting?
It's good, right? You have an identifier that, you know, links things back. Without it, I think it's hard to keep track of all this stuff. I guess piling on, since we already mentioned, you know, smartphones earlier, you know, there's a great cell phone company actually based in Amsterdam called Fairphone. And they've, you know, really embraced this idea of circularity. Their key performance metrics focus on things like fair materials and factories, you know, extending the life of their product, how much e-waste they're taking back. And while the phones can't, you know, they aren't for sale yet in the US, definitely buy one when they get there. They offer a 5-year warranty, 8 years of software support. 70% of the phones are made with fair or what they call recycled materials. You can swap a battery out at a moment's notice. And, you know, there's even a subscription service if you just want to subscribe to having a phone and they take care of all the rest. So,
wow.
Yeah, so really cool example. And there are obviously many others of companies really taking the initiative.
And I think along those lines, maybe we also want to speak about the fact that the European Council has adopted rules that by 2027 will require smartphone manufacturers to have user replaceable batteries in them. I think this is the pressure that organizations like Apple needed to force them to make their gear easy to work on.
Yeah, totally agree.
Yeah, definitely. And before we get into the kind of practical part of this, which is what we can do, we have our little listener comments section. Since we've been asking folks to tell us about their climate actions or questions and suggestions for the podcast. So this week, our listener comment was from Wes Tater, who recently joined our circle of monthly donors. He discovered our show through our episode on the UN climate process and wondered if we'd ever done an episode on carbon pricing, and more specifically, a carbon fee and dividend. The answer is yes, but almost 3 years ago. So we're going to take a fresh look at the topic during our upcoming fall season, autumn season. Sorry, Thomas. We always, always appreciate hearing from y'all. If you've recently taken climate action, have a question, or even just a note, please, please, please head to our website and drop a comment.
Well, with that, let's move to, you know, options for what each of us can do to be part of the solution and in our move to circularity. And first option we have this week is take a moment to, you know, look up your state, province, or country and see if they have extended producer responsibility legislation in place. If they do, you know, call on them to, you know, expand it to include all major, you know, consumer product categories. And if they don't, call on them to pass extended producer responsibility.
And I guess the other item from a what can we do perspective is let's get out there and fix something. You know, we've all probably got something around our house that's either half worn out or broken or whatever and just needs a little bit of love and attention to get back up on its feet again. And I recently just fixed my wood fire and I've, you know, totally redesigned the internals on that and it runs now more efficiently than it ever did before. And it Ooh. Feels great to take something that was like 100 kilos of steel and bricks to, you know, have that back up and running again and not end up in a scrap pile somewhere. So it's an awesome feeling, and often it's a new skill that we can take on board. It helps challenge our minds and you know, equips us with something that might be useful to us in the future.
Yeah, I think it's a great call to action, Thomas. You know, whether it's mending that shirt that has a hole in it, or you know, fixing your stove, it's a great way to be part of the circular economy. So, you know, reduce, reuse, and recycle. Well, that's all we have for this week's episode. Thanks to everybody for tuning in. As a reminder, as Thomas mentioned in the beginning, with this shift to seasons, we definitely want to stay connected with you. So take a minute to go over to our website and sign up for our newsletter, and make sure, again, that you're subscribed on your podcasting platform. Climate Optimists is made possible by Climate Stewards Collective. You can find us on the web at climateoptimists.co. And don't forget to follow us on social at Climate Optimist Podcast.